Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us the bright and early hour of 8:30 a.m. We will hear from a very distinguished panel of experts on what can academe do, and we're going to approach this from a variety of perspectives, and we hope that, we tried to choose a panel that could talk about this topic from a variety of perspectives, and I hope we've achieved that goal. I'll introduce the panelists in the order that they'll speak. We'll let them each speak for their time allotted, and then we'll have time at the end for Q&A. We might have questions of each other. We certainly want to hear questions from you, and we can also have just a conversation. So I'll just start by introducing myself, though I'm going last, so I've already violated the instructions that I just gave you. But my name is Nagai Pindell. I'm the Vice Provost for Faculty Affairs at UNLV. But wait, there's more. I've got other titles. I am the International Gaming Institute Professor of Law. So it's my affiliation with the law school and also the Director of Gaming Programs at the law school. So by dint of the titles, you can see the connections between myself and gaming, between myself and the IGI, and the partnerships that the law school and the IGI have developed. Our other panelists who will begin are, so Bo Bernhard. I'm not going to introduce Bo because you've heard a lot about Bo, but Bo, director of IGI. And then we'll hear from Andre Wilsonok, our new director of the International Center for Gaming Regulation. And then we will hear from Debbie LaPlante, who is the Director of Research and Academic Affairs at the Division on Addiction, Cambridge Health Alliance at Harvard Medical School. And then we'll hear from Khalil Philander, who is the Director of Social Responsibility at the British Columbia Lottery Corporation. And then finally, I'll have some more thoughts at the end about the LLM program that we've developed at the law school and other initiatives that we are thinking about. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Bo.
So the spirit of this one's actually very much the spirit of this conference, and we're going to talk a little bit about our bridge-building efforts at our university that, of course, then extend out to other universities. Certainly in Debbie's case, we've worked on a number of projects together, other government industry organizations like BCLC. And the story begins, really, with the International Gaming Institute itself. I talked a little in the opening keynote about how we combined forces with the University of Nevada, Reno's gaming programs. We had two separate programs where we worked together a lot, but we combined forces a few years back. And one of the things that happened to us between the last conference and this conference is we were approached by our president's office at the university. And the exact sort of line of questioning was something along these lines. The International Gaming Institute, those of you who are academics will recognize and perhaps smile at this, was very much confined within a college structure. And we reported to deans and to college budget managers and a very narrow hierarchy there. And the president's office approached us and they said, well, why does one college get to have you? You're an International Gaming Institute. You're in Las Vegas, and all of our projects had been multidisciplinary, really. And as those conversations sort of unfolded, one of the things we started to look at were other successful institutes that achieved strong multidisciplinary objectives. And one of the things we noticed was, two things. One is that they did very well with multidisciplinary projects. And the other was they sort of escaped the silos of individual colleges and leapt to different levels of the hierarchy. So specifically in our case, the university asked us to become the first university center of excellence. So we are a university-wide entity now, which means I don't report to a dean, I report to a president. But the really great thing about that is one college doesn't just get us. We do get to do we engage in all sorts of different partnerships. I see friends in criminology that we have partnerships with. The partnership we're going to talk to you about with the law school is a fully 50-50 project going after gaming regulation. And in studying other institutes, some of the really successful ones we saw, we noticed were parent institutes with then centers underneath them. And these centers focused on areas of strategic importance for either the regional economy or for, you know, or based on the strengths of their faculty. And so we started to look at that relative to what we did and what we have in our backyard, of course, and all that goes along with Las Vegas. So we first started to partner with the Department of Mathematics and the Department of Engineering, the College of Engineering, rather, in looking at sort of a unique way for a university to score points, frankly. We are one of those universities that's trying to rise up these crazy rankings that we have of research universities. And one of the key metrics, actually several key metrics, are related to intellectual property, and specifically patents, startups, commercialization, all this stuff, you know, that university presidents love to talk about in demonstrating a connection with the community outside of the university's doors. And so as we started to think about that, we started to realize that there was a real opportunity that was unique perhaps in gambling, in that gambling games are patentable. We had a bunch of math whiz kids, economics whiz kids, students in engineering who had interesting ideas, computer programmers who came to us as well, could program these. So that actually turned into a class. It was called Game Innovation. And we were really hopeful that if we had this multidisciplinary class where we basically invited the whole campus, and eventually, I should say, we opened it up beyond campus, we would get maybe one or two interesting gambling game designs that the students would invent with the mentorship of faculty from across campus. And maybe one of those games we would then show to somebody in the industry, and they'd sort of pat us on the back and say, that's a really interesting game. That looks great. And we'd never hear from them again, but they'd be really nice to us, right, and supportive, and we'd get perhaps one patent out of this. In fact, when CBS News this morning, which is the highest rated morning show in America, ended up covering this, and Charlie Rose, who's a famous journalist here, came out and interviewed the director of this program, Mark Yoseloff, who's been here. He said, you know, how many games did you expect to invent out of this class? And he said, mathematically speaking, and he's a mathematician with a PhD from Princeton, somewhere between zero and one. We patented 12 games in the first semester of the class. And the reason was bridges. It really was. The reason was you could answer almost any question you could have about inventing a gambling game with just the resources available with the very multidisciplinary body of students and faculty and experts that were convened in that room. So it's one of these realizations why and how multidisciplinary thinking can be so powerful, right? Because any kind of answer you can need can be available to you if you have a large enough and diverse enough and most multidisciplinary team, right? And so once more, this diversity theme that we've been talking about throughout this semester, I think, came to light there. We recently hit our 30th patent, or at least 30th patent in the patent process. To give you some context, UNLV is a young university. It's like everything else in UNLV. We're very, very young, and we have tons of growing pains, but we're growing very, very fast. It very much mirrors Las Vegas. The entire university, 3 years ago, had three patents university-wide. This program alone is now in the 30th patent and the various patent processes. Joe Wilcock back there has gotten involved in the gambling game invention. It really is a fun spirit. And so again, our idea was, well, this is an area where we can actually contribute intellectual property, we can train students on this, we can build intellectual property potentially that is then purchased, and just one of many success stories. The first game that was sold, a woman in our class who happened to grow up in Vietnam and invented a gambling game that she saw her grandmother play, modified for gambling. And to modify it for gambling, you have to have really good mathematicians in the room. And so she worked with the mathematicians. She signed the contract on her 21st birthday. It paid for her entire undergraduate education. She's an international student. And as those of you who are in the business know, that's our business model. We charge through the roof with those students. And with one stroke of the pen, through a class, right, she was able to pay for that, which is kind of a remarkable thing. So we thought we were onto something, and our first center of strategic import is this Center for Game Innovation. We now have Knowledge Fund funding for that. I talked a little bit about the Knowledge Fund in the opening of this conference. And they then asked us if that was, you know, that was so successful, can you expand it out to the entire integrated resort? Certainly, those of you that are staying here know that there are bottlenecks everywhere, right? There are bottlenecks at check-in. There are bottlenecks at the pool. There are bottlenecks at valet. what if you could invent something that could ease and smooth those sorts of things over? And the governor's office came to us and said, could you expand this out to the entire place and look at the entire animal that is these massive buildings? And we said, sure. And then we had to do it. And so we went out and found actually a brilliant individual from industry. He's not here today. He was unfortunately in a car accident. But Robert Rippey was the name that everybody in the industry said, there's one guy in this industry that thinks that way and has been chief innovation officer all over the place. And he now is heading up our hospitality lab, which just concluded its first round of inventions. And I've learned this. I can't talk about Fight Club. I can't tell you about the kinds of inventions that just happened in there. But man, they were cool. Sorry, that's what I have to. I mean, there were a couple of ideas that will, again, if they come to fruition, completely transform the hotel room. And for those of you who saw, Robert Rippey actually was here earlier this week, running his robot around. It's an automated robot, so it navigates the world by itself. Amazing stuff. And so that then again became our second real center at the Institute. The third one's the one we're here to talk about, actually. And it is very much, again, a multidisciplinary entity. I mean, fully a partnership across campus that would not have probably happened had we continued to be confined within a single college. And once more, our hope was that this will answer the question, what can academe do? This will be a situation where there will be impacts well beyond our campus that extend well beyond our borders of our university out into the community, out into the economy. So I want to tell you a little bit about what our thinking was as we came up with the International Center for Gaming Regulation. One of the things we recognized, certainly everybody here recognizes, is that gaming is very much a global industry, right? This was not the case in 1974 when Bill first hosted this meeting. It was actually, you know, very much a multinational industry, but the interconnectivity wasn't there, right? It wasn't like we had companies that existed in 300 jurisdictions like we do today with the IGTs and the Cygames, or companies like Las Vegas Sands, which operate in three countries, right? So what happens with this industry is ownership, management, technology, business practice, policy, they can span both local and international borders. However, the regulation of gambling has to stop at the border. And in the U.S. in the 80s, I'm hesitant to invoke this with a really smart crowd, but the number one show in America was The Dukes of Hazzard. People remember this show? And here is the plot device that happened seemingly every episode of The Dukes of Hazzard. The crazy guys, the crazy protagonists, the Duke boys, were in their car, and they were running from the police. And they would be driving really, really fast to get to the border of maybe Alabama, was it? I don't even know where. Was it? Hazzard County. Where was Hazzard County? Georgia? Okay, Georgia? Okay. I'm glad we have a smart and informed audience here. I was worried about throwing this reference out there. It's a horrible show. I mean, just in retrospect, 80s pop culture, we really made some bad decisions. But here's what happened. The Duke boys would make it over the border, and the highway patrolman behind him would have to screech to a halt, and like it was like his cop car couldn't even go over into the other jurisdiction, and they'd go, woohoo, we escaped, ha, ha, ha. They're laughing at the guy in the cop car who had to screech to a halt at the border, right? And that's kind of the way gaming regulation works now, right? In that, you're governing, by definition, companies that are all over the world, that are themselves operating in up to 300 plus jurisdictions. And yet your jurisdiction, your area of governance, screeches to a halt often at that border. There are certainly multinational organizations. IAGR comes to mind, and certainly there are other more regional ones. But in general, regulation is sequestered within a specific jurisdiction. So you can probably see where I'm headed here. Our thinking was there is a need for pan-border, pan-jurisdictional, pan-national voices to contribute something useful to this debate, given this sort of structural constraint that often exists. And this can, of course, lead to very differing and very conflicting responses to regulatory challenges, right? You can operate, for example, in Nevada, and as you move the machines over the border into California, you face very different rules, very different paperwork, very different requirements. The truck itself that is driving the machine has to do all sorts of backflips just to pass the border. It can be a very complex landscape. There are all sorts of, as we said, organizations that do this, that convene typically once per year, like we're doing here, the world's regulators. And so each of these entities in various ways convene folks, right? And again, to use an illustration, IAGR and IAGA are the International Association of Gaming Attorneys and the International Association of Gaming Regulators. And here's what happens. And I go to every one of these meetings. These are some of my favorite meetings. I say this as someone who has deep, deep affection for these meetings. Here's what happens almost every year at these meetings. Will bring up a really hot topic, right? And everybody will get all excited about it. And then somebody will raise their hand and they say, wait, wasn't this what so-and-so was talking about a year ago when we met in New York? What's happened since then? And everybody sort of looks around at each other and says, yeah, nothing. Because these are bodies that are set up really around their annual event, right? That is their reason for existence. That is, to a significant degree, what their often one-person staff is working towards. And so the event itself is fantastic, but it's not a permanent resource, and it's certainly not, of course, an academic resource. So there are a number of challenges that policymakers and regulators face. Knowledge is, of course, very unevenly distributed amongst industry participants, professional advisors, and regulatory bodies in multiple geographies. For years, regulatory bodies would come to us at the International Gaming Institute and say, hey, we're totally new to this. This happened in the past 18 months with Japan, when Japan looked like they might bring in integrated resorts. We're completely new to this. We have no idea about regulating gaming. Can you put together a custom program, which we were always happy to do? We now do under the umbrella of this new center. But very often, as many of you know, and you know, regulators in the room will attest, gaming regulators are appointed not because they have this 30-year history of deep, deep study of gaming law and policy. They're in that seat because they sat behind the prime minister in the second grade, right? Or they have known the governor for some time, and they'll come to us behind closed academic doors when we hold these classes and say, look, I got to tell you, I'm a banker. I don't know anything about gambling. And they can't project that in public because they are now official government officials, right? But behind closed doors, we got tremendous amounts of insecurity, and it was reminiscent to us, as we talked about law schools, of the judicial college concept. So one of the things that, as a judge in the US, you can and often, I think, have to do, is attend, right as you become a judge, a judicial college, right? And part of what it is really being a judge 101, right? Evaluating evidence, sifting through various types of data or information or testimony, and trying to weigh all of that and arrive at a good decision. Well, that doesn't exist for gaming regulators until now. There's no common platform, really, for these different stakeholders to congregate to sort of advance the field of study. In fact, one could easily argue there is no field of study of gaming regulation. Certainly there is of gaming policy more generally, and a lot of those policy studies inevitably deal with gaming regulation. But it's not as if you're a gaming regulator, I said this at the opening, it's not as if you can make a decision and in addition to hearing whatever the presentations say from a gaming operator, you can then turn to a research literature and say, okay, across the world there are 300 gaming jurisdictions, 215 of them do it this way, and here are the outcomes that we've measured post-implementation of that regulation, and here's the efficacy, right? You totally have to go with your gut as a gaming regulator, with your intuition, which is the kind of vacuum that a research scientist loves, right? We drool over those moments when there are intuition-driven moments that end up being really important. So again, as we were thinking at the Gaming Institute of areas that where we could make an impact, and if we can make an impact, why not? Let's put together another center of excellence. This center started to make sense. There are all sorts of independence and conflict of interest situations, obviously, in any regulatory scenario, and certainly in gaming. And our hope was that the independence and scientific research-based nature of a university would at least help with that particular situation. There are more ideas and concepts available than there are resources, right? There are a million consultants out there. There are a million opinions. Everybody's got one, right? But there really aren't central archives or there aren't very many, I should say, central archives or resources available. Gambling Compliance certainly comes to mind as a fantastic resource. But it's not as if, again, there are vast resources available to regulators. So this is what we were thinking, especially amongst new gaming entrants. And we're focusing here on Japan and Brazil because this was yesterday and today's, respectively, hot new jurisdiction, right? Last year at this time, everybody was talking about Japan and how Tokyo was going to implement $10 billion integrated resorts. That has cooled off considerably. Brazil is now the new Japan, and Brazil is certainly a place where now we are hearing much talk of the possibility of implementing, of constructing, issuing RFPs perhaps, and then regulating massive multi-billion dollar integrated resorts. So here's what they require, we think, scientific findings to rely on rather than intuition in decision-making, making these key decisions. These are the most expensive buildings in the world. And once you build one, you effectively, as a government, become sort of a partner. Because if you build the most expensive thing in the world in your backyard, it's kind of tough to back out of that thing, right? When you think about the Marina Bay Sands in the heart of Singapore, I mean, when you build, what was at that time, the world's most expensive building, a $6 billion building, that's not something where if that goes south, you can just sort of throw a bedsheet over it and say, oh yeah, that chapter, we're not doing that anymore, right? It really is a sort of a unique challenge in the global economy and in global policy. Again, when Steve Wynn, who opened this conference, opened Wynn Las Vegas across the street, he announced to the world, this is the most expensive, I'm doing the Steve Wynn voice, this is the most expensive building man has ever built. Is that good? Was that the end? The pyramids, adjusted for inflation, did not cost what my building just cost. And I don't know how he did his inflationary math. I didn't check with Brad Wimmer or other economists or Khalil to see, you know. But if we do accept that that was, in fact, the most expensive, that was a $3 billion building in 2005, in 2006, 2007, 2008, we saw buildings like the Singapore Marina Bay Sands open at $6 billion, effectively doubling the most expensive thing on Earth. We then saw down the street City Center, which, if the accounting was honest, might be a $12 billion thing, right? Which is now the most expensive building on Earth. Again, if you're a new jurisdiction in particular, this can obviously lead to some significant challenges. And of course, we want people to have access to information, right? Transparency and access. So universities are great at this, at archiving, having wonderful libraries. We, I believe, have the best gaming library on the planet under Dave Schwartz at UNLV. And then, of course, there are all these sort of technical issues as people try to, regulators understandably try to navigate the complex world of gaming technology. While even though we often mock the relatively primitive technology of a slot machine, especially compared to a lot of technologies that you can play on in the broader sense, you know, the VR games and all these sorts of things you can do now, it is, in fact, a very complex technical animal. And again, having the technical expertise and regulatory best practices turns out to be fairly important. So with this, we decided that our third area of focus would, in fact, be what is now, and again, in a full 50-50 partnership between the Gaming Institute and the law school, UNLV's International Center for Gaming Regulation. And I gave a long, I continue to give longer and longer winded introductions of Andre with hopes of embarrassing him more and more and more. But this is an individual who has built things. This is an individual who, with the new South Africa, was deeply and intimately involved with building a regulatory structure and then overseeing a regulatory structure, as casinos played a very important role during the early heady days as a job creator and with some very noble goals. Certainly Don Ross has written extensively about this, right? And then, of course, as he moved on to the UK, as the UK tackled this interesting new chapter of internet gaming, and when that was a new and crazy thing, and how do you regulate this thing, Andre played a central role, again, as the chief regulator in Alderney, of overseeing that important chapter. So we've asked him to build something, again, because he's built a few things. Please join me in welcoming Andre Wilsonock. He'll talk to you about the International Center for Gaming Regulation.
Thanks, Bo. Morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's such a pleasure to tell you a little bit about this new initiative of ours. Many people have asked me, and just this morning over coffee, how's it going? I mean, it made a lot of sense for you to move from South Africa to Europe and the UK. South Africa has for a long time been a colony of England. And there's been a long-standing relationship, as you might know, so that's probably made a lot of sense. But moving to the west coast of the U.S., and my only answer to them is, have you listened to Bo Bernard speaking? And if you haven't, come and join this session, because that will tell you everything. You know, it's wonderful how people inspire you to do great things. I've been very fortunate in South Africa to have been asked to be there right at the start of gaming in just after the first democratic elections in 1994, and it was a great time. And as I said to someone the other day, we then got into the boring stuff after we've issued about 40 licenses and these big casinos that Bo has just spoken about came out of the ground, and it was all exciting all over South Africa. And then we got into compliance and enforcement and the boring sort of stuff, right, that no one wants to really do, and no one takes credit for that. I became a little bit frustrated because the South African government was not going to take the opportunity to get into online gaming when Peter Dean, whom some of you might know, was the chairman of the UK Gaming Authority, said, listen, we have responsibility for the British Channel Islands who've gone into online gaming. We don't know anything about it. We know you're keen on that. And so Peter inspired me to do that, which I'm immensely grateful for, because having been in Europe over the last 14 years, observing the liberalization of gaming in Europe has been an immense pleasure. It is one of the greatest experiences I've had. Eva Bakun, who's sitting here and who observes these things on a daily basis, would know exactly what I'm talking about. It is fascinating to see what's happening in Europe and now in Eastern Europe and so on. And then another inspiring man came across my path, Bo Bernard. And I remember the day after we'd spoken about this opportunity, when I got home, I started talking to my wife about it, and she said, what was it like? And I started telling her about it, and she said, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, you're talking three octaves higher. What's wrong? And I said, well, you know, I've just spoken to the most inspiring guy about, you know, the center. And, you know, having listened to him this morning, you will know why I say that. I'm going to just shortly, I'm not going to spend too much time, I'm going to tell you a few things about the center, what we've done so far. I've only been in the position for 4 months. I have staff as of 2 weeks ago, whom I'm going to introduce to you in a minute. So it's really, really early days, right? But we have great plans, and I want to share those with you. As Bo said, it's a joint partnership between the William Boyd School of Law, and having had the opportunity to work with Guy Pendel, it's just a wonderful partnership. Having Bo on the one side and Guy Dean Dan Hamilton has been it's just been a great experience. Let me introduce you to who we are. I'm very fortunate to have recruited some great people to help me with this. Jennifer Roberts, whom some of you might know, has been appointed as the associate director. Jennifer is a gaming lawyer by background, cut her teeth at Lionel Sawyer in the early days here in Las Vegas, then moved to Duane Morris, and we were really fortunate to get her on her way into establishing her own practice. For those of you that don't know, Jennifer is going to defend DFS at the mock trial later this afternoon at 2 p.m., and she's going to take the side, or argue the side of not regulating DFS. So those of you that take an interest in DFS, certainly go and have a listen at that. We were also fortunate to recruit Rob Hogan, who's sitting at the back, who came straight out of MGM Corporate Services, where he was dealing with executive management training. And we were also very fortunate on a part-time basis to acquire the services of someone who's also sitting at the back there, Dennis Amerine. Dennis, in his early days, was a member of the Nevada Gaming Control Board. I got to know Dennis about 25 years ago. Dennis has been involved over the many years in training regulators around the world, and we were very fortunate to get him on a part-time basis. We thought it was quite important that to promote good governance, to as quickly as possible set up an advisory board. I'm very fortunate to have Mark Leporelli on that board. Mark is well known as a regulator, currently a senator in the legislature here in Nevada, someone with immense background in gaming, not just gaming itself, but gaming regulation. Tony Cabot need no introduction. You all know Tony. Peter Cohen, former regulator from Victoria in Australia. And then Jenny Williams, who most of you might know as well, former CEO of the UK Gaming Commission. This picture isn't complete as yet. We're going to certainly add one or two more names. We want to make sure that it is truly an international picture and not a US picture. I feel very strong about it, that the center should be an international center and not the American center for gaming regulation. We've also, in order to maintain a very rigorous and stringent firewall in terms of making sure that we have independent research, objective research, we've recently appointed an academic council. And again, this picture isn't complete. If you don't see your name there, don't be offended by that. Please approach us. We would love to work with you. I cannot emphasize enough the importance of having relationships with academics in this area around the world. And if you feel you can make a contribution and your name isn't there as yet, please talk to me. As Bo has said, there's sort of three. The main objective is to promote best regulatory practices around the world. I can't say it better than he has said it. Unfortunately, all over the world, we have these garden walls between different jurisdictions. What internet fortunately is doing these days, it's bringing those garden walls down a bit, because internet is really a cross-border industry. It has not been designed to take place in a particular jurisdiction. And although governments and jurisdictions for tax purposes mainly and for responsible gaming purposes are trying to lock it into state borders, it's quite a struggle and it isn't really, in my mind, very effective. But having said that, it's quite important that regulators over the world start thinking about the way in which they regulate. Having been a regulator most of my life, it is just unfortunately a fact that they are not too exposed to academic conferences such as these. They don't read academic material. They see academics as, you know, this crazy bunch who's sitting, you know, in ivory towers up there doing research for the sake of research and not really impacting, you know, the work that we do on a daily basis. And the challenge really of this center is going to be, how do we bring those two worlds together, all right? And I think we've got a great opportunity, obviously taking hands with the likes of you, to help us doing that. So how are we going to change the world? Firstly, by way of research. Secondly, education. And thirdly, by disseminating information. And let me quickly deal with those three topics in a nutshell. As far as research is concerned, we think it's important to as quickly as possible do research that is of importance and value of to regulators. One of the things that we've already started doing is a research project led by one of our student workers at the back, Ashley Kalina. Hi, Ashley. Is leading a project on how does regulation impact innovation in this particular sector. This sector has for a very long time been seen as a niche sector and not being part of the mainstream economy, right? It's got to become part of the mainstream economy. It's got to be regulated in the way which the finance sector is regulated. We're often stuck with regulation because we come from a background, you know, of crime in the early days, and therefore we have these odd structures and ways in which we approach regulation and duplicate it around the world. The only way we can change that is to put up the mirror to some of these regulators around the world in a nice way, and show them there's a better way, a more effective way of doing that to promote innovation and so on. We've also called for fellowships, research fellowships, and we are fortunate to have in excess of 10 applications on the table, which we're going to look at, and I'm so excited about it, to look at it in the next week or two. There's some interesting topics there. Esports came up there, daily fantasy sports, crime in gaming, and innovation and so on. So there's a number of interesting topics, and we really look forward to awarding those topics and get the research program going. The second objective is to do it by way of education. And just very basically, the approach that we're going to follow is to, if you look at that middle column, is to develop, and we're busy developing this curriculum at the moment, first of all, a basic regulatory certification program aimed at land-based, to do something similar for the iGaming sector, and then to be able to drill down into specific areas. It's one thing to provide regulators with the basic programs of how do you conduct investigations and licensing and auditing and, you know, all of those sort of things. But there's often a need in some of these well-equipped, well-resourced regulatory authorities to be able to drill down and to take, for example, a group that specifically focuses in an area such as licensing and investigations or the auditing or compliance or enforcement and drill down on that. We hope to do it by way of open enrollment. We're also going to develop and provide custom programs for regulators. So if a regulator says, listen, you know, we have a need in a particular area, they can make up their own course that to suit them, and the whole way we develop it is very modular, so that we have all the ingredients on the table, and you can really build your own pizza and put the ingredients on there that are relevant to your particular authority. So we don't want to just come with standard programs, and address things that are not necessarily needs. And then there's very topical issues. DFS is one, esports is another one, AML is another one on the right-hand side that we really want to quickly do things about and be able to teach in those particular areas. And then thirdly, I think it's quite important that we provide a platform or a thought center, if you wish, where we can convene stakeholders. I spoke earlier about the issue of innovation and how innovation touches on regulation. It might not be too popular once you've done empirical analysis and you've got evidence-based information to go out to the world and say, you know, listen, this is how bad X, Y, and Z jurisdictions have done. But what might be useful is to get those jurisdictions around a table and start talking about what have we found? What does the evidence show? And start influencing on a smaller basis rather than on a public basis the way that those operators work. As you very well know, regulators don't like being challenged. They don't like being offended, certainly not in public. And so we've got to do it in a way where we really work with them rather than against them. We think it's important to provide expert advice. And I can see, and we've already had approaches of regulatory jurisdictions around the world asking us for advice. We will provide independent testimony before legislatures, for regulators, as we are asked. And then obviously to provide that think tank environment. Ladies and gentlemen, that's really our mission. That's the vision out there. This is how we want to do it. And as I've said before, I really hope to take hands with colleagues around the world in making this a success. Thank you very much.
Is always the hardest part. Play. Awesome, thank you. All right, thank you. My name is Debbie LaPlante, and I am a social psychologist, and I study addictive behavior from a public health perspective. So in thinking about the question that was posed to this panel, what can we contribute to the conversation about regulation? I was thinking about it from the perspective of responsible gambling. And I needed to step back a little bit and think to myself, you know, what are the types of things it's changing on here, but not on there. There we go. Okay. Sorry about that. Technical difficulties. What are the types of things that, here we go, that currently people are using, and either the industry imposing it upon themselves or having it imposed externally by some type of oversight body. And it includes a variety of different things, including requirements for employee education, providing resources on site, such as self-exclusion ability, signage, helpline capability, advertising and marketing restrictions, alcohol, credit restrictions, loss and stake limitation possibilities, those kinds of tools, and mitigation efforts, including providing funding for treatment and, more popularly, funding for research in different communities. And true to what Bo was saying earlier today, things are really segmented by jurisdiction. This here is a graph that the AGA actually published probably about 10 years ago. But it sounds like things are pretty similar today, that these types of regulations and these types of interventions, the policies that are required, are really, it's kind of all over the map about what's required and where it is. And there's probably a lot of different reasons why that might be, and one of it might just be how regulations tend to emerge. And they can emerge from a variety of sources, including just public opinion, what do people think about what should be done, political lobbying by special interest groups, expert advice, common sense, just thinking it through, what makes sense to people about what should be regulated and how that should happen. Also reacting to situations, what kind of outcomes have happened, and providing policies that seem to address different outcomes that maybe are unwanted or ones that you want to try to draw out in a particular situation. The big question, I think, today is whether or not empirical evaluation, you know, should be on this list. What would it look like if it were? I think that if empirical evaluation were involved in the development of regulations and policies, it might look something like this. Maybe researchers and oversight bodies and the industry would work together to develop some type of regulation. And in that regulation, you would build in automatically some type of outcome monitoring system in which you could assess and analyze and summarize what the impact of the regulation actually is. This would need to be some type of an iterative process where the feedback and reporting would go back and take a look at what was the regulation that you proposed? What impact does it have? Does it need to be changed? People would need to be willing to do away with regulations that maybe don't have the effects that you want and start anew. Why would you want to do that? Well, I think that there are a variety of reasons. Until you actually evaluate a particular regulation, you don't know what outcome it's going to have. In the case of responsible gambling, a regulation that's designed to minimize gambling harms actually could decrease those gambling-related harms. It also could increase those harms, incidentally. It could have no effect. You could be spending a lot of money and ultimately not having a big impact. Or you could be influencing gambling-related problems indirectly through other factors that you're not measuring. It's really unclear. So here's an example that kind of makes this a little bit more apparent of why you want to actually evaluate the regulations that you're installing. In the United States, at a lot of ballparks, during about the seventh inning, they stopped selling alcohol. And they do this for good reasons. They want to reduce the rates of intoxication. Maybe they don't want people driving under the influence after the game is done, or maybe they don't want people drunk and getting in fights. And this happens at about the seventh inning. What do you think happens in the sixth inning? Binge drinking. So a lot of times in the sixth inning, people will go to the beer stalls and they'll get three or four drinks and to get them through the rest of the game, because God forbid that they stop drinking when alcohol sales are done. So this is an example of an unintended consequence for a regulation that was installed for, you know, the best of intentions to reduce the likelihood of unwanted drinking outcomes. Here's another example. That was an anecdotal evidence that I thought of and talked about with my colleagues at the division just from getting a little bit too much beer spilled on me during the late innings of games that I go to at the Red Sox. Bike riding. A lot of communities in the United States are requiring that children start wearing bike helmets. And this is because they want to reduce brain trauma from kids that don't ride their bikes very well and maybe fall off and hit their heads. These communities are finding a reduction in the amount of head trauma for kids, bike-related head trauma, but they're also finding something else. They're finding that the kids in these communities are riding their bikes less. Now, in a country that's fighting a war on obesity, that's an unintended consequence of this regulation. You want to have kids be as physically active as you possibly can. It's important to look at the regulations that we install, even when we have very good intentions, and make sure that we're not inducing more problems than we anticipated. Bo, if you want to feel old, about 12 years ago, you published your On the Shoulders of Merton paper, which I love, and pointed out that in gambling, we have the same type of possibilities. There are possibilities for well-intended regulations to go wrong. Here's a couple examples. Maximum bet limits have the possibility of reducing the amount that people are spending, but also inducing longer play. People are spending more time, slowing the real speed. Maybe their people's play is slowed down, and that's a good thing, but it also could potentially stimulate more aggressive play. Removing bill acceptors at games. Maybe people are spending less during a particular length of time, but they're also maybe recognizing the amount of money that they're spending less well because they're looking at it in terms of credits instead of dollars. Win-loss displays. Maybe you have a better understanding of the money that you're actually spending, but maybe it induces chasing losses if you see those losses mounting up. Self-limits. Is your impulsive play limited, or are you overestimating the amount of time that you actually want to spend? Maybe you would leave earlier. Random timeouts. Are you providing gamblers with the amount of time to kind of reflect about what they're doing? Or are you inducing potentially other complicated public health issues? Maybe they stop, maybe they start drinking more. Maybe they eat more. Maybe they start smoking more. We have to think about a broad range of potential outcomes of the various regulations and policies that we install. So what do we actually know about responsible gambling regulations? Well, I'm going to say until Bo and Guy and Andre get busy, we don't know a whole lot as of yet. There isn't a great deal of research on responsible gambling regulations, but I do think that it is important to evaluate them. How can we do this? I'm going to suggest that the best ways to go about this include prospective research rather than cross-sectional research. And this way, we can potentially start to disentangle some of the temporal relationships between causes and effects, and also consideration of randomized trials. And this would require, you know, kind of intense cooperation between oversight bodies and independent evaluators in the industry. What can science tell us and what can't science tell us? Well, I would suggest that science probably could tell us a little bit about the costs and benefits of different regulations. And it also can tell you about how regulations might intervene within the natural course of gambling-related problems. What it really can't tell us is how much weight to apply to individual liberty versus government oversight in the intention to prevent harm. That really is a question for the people and for the representatives of the people. So the challenge to us as potential partners from the academic world, from the industry side, from the oversight side, is to recognize that gambling can both create challenges in everyday life and opportunities to improve everyday life. We need to be aware of those challenges and to help people navigate them safely, and hopefully to focus on a pathway that uses evidence-based policies that minimize unintended outcomes. Thank you very much.
So I have no slides, so I don't know if I can hold the screen there. That's great. So I'm not an academic. I'm a reformed academic now. I work, as the guy mentioned, at BCLC, which is in some respects a regulator and in some respects an operator. It's a very weird model that I won't go on about. But suffice to say, I think there's a lot of ways that, you know, a center like this or research that can help, and I guess what I wanted to do was kind of wax on a little bit about the problems that I have so that perhaps people in this room can help me find solutions. You know, I was having this conversation with John Kelly, who's the CEO of the Responsible Gambling Council, a few months ago, and we were talking about, you know, regulators and policy decisions and how we actually implement these things. And I was telling him it's so helpful to have organizations like yours that can take what might be a very broad idea, say something like you know, a responsible gambling tool that allows you to set limits, and actually provide a little bit more direction on what that really needs to look like operationally. Mm-hmm. And John had the funny comment where he said, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I talk to people like this all the time, and they say, John, what color do I make this device, red or blue? I got to pick one of them. And that's the issue that we really get in is, you know, a lot of times if you know, regulations are half-baked and they don't provide clear direction, then for people who ultimately have to influence these things, they don't know what the global standard is. They don't know what's worked in other jurisdictions, and certainly, you know, not everybody is a subject matter expert. And, you know, this goes to the regulators as well. One thing that I've really noticed, I've been in my role for a year and a half, is that, like Beau mentioned, that regulators are often bureaucrats who aren't necessarily people who have, you know, come up through the industry and understand the business very well. And, you know, not everybody has a Nevada Gaming Control Board, which is, you know, a world-class facility with people who are all well-educated. Often it's, you know, people who've worked elsewhere in government and all of a sudden are now thrust into this role where they have to work and regulate an industry where everybody that they're dealing with has been in that role and is a subject matter expert, and there's a complete imbalance of knowledge about what needs to happen or what should be done, and their education oftentimes is coming from the industry that they're regulating. And so I think, you know, an organization like this, and, you know, I just love the education program that Andre put up, which was, you know, what's the minimum criteria that you should have when you enter into a regulation role? I think that's something that's sorely needed because, you know, without that, there's certainly a great conflict of interest that can happen whenever somebody goes into a new regulatory role. One other thing that, you know, I would love to see more of in research is knowledge translation. So Travis works for the Gambling Research Exchange of Ontario, GRIO, which does a tremendous job of this in responsible gambling, but there's a huge gap of this knowledge translation in other areas of gaming regulation, like anti-money laundering, security and compliance. These types of institutions just don't exist, and for people who don't have an academic background, it's impossible to, I mean, for one, even just accessing academic journals for institutions that don't have that access. So I think there's a lot of value that, you know, organizations like mine could definitely get from there. And, you know, another thing that strikes me is once that subject matter expertise, that knowledge translation exists, then we can start to get a better sense of what are the global standards. I have conversations every day from colleagues across Canada saying, well, what do you do on this subject? I don't know. Well, what do you do? And it's just the most inefficient system possible, but it's the only one that works for us right now, because there is no organization which is defining what are the best practices, what are the standards. And world standards are so important for us in our program. And to give you an example, BCLC has a self-exclusion program that so people can sign up and they'll be barred from the casino. And as part of this program, if you breach your self-exclusion and you end up winning a prize, that prize is withheld, so you don't get that money. And this is designed to be an incentive to keep you from coming in and playing. And BCLC has been sued by people who've come in, won jackpots, and had that money withheld. And the reason why I bring this up is because through the lawsuits that went to trial, what was eventually part of the judge's decision is the duty of care that BCLC has is influenced by what are the world standards for programs like this. And in making those decisions, they had to look at individual jurisdictions and what they were doing. But if there is a well-reputed third party, like an academic institution that is, you know, telling the world these are the minimum standards for programs like this, then the duty of care is quite clear, and we can, you know, confidently go ahead and know what our program has to look like. We don't know that right now, and so, you know, a lot of the ways in which we're making decisions around that program are haphazard with what is our duty of care to provide for players. We have a I think a bias to being overprotective, but, you know, we just don't have that direction from anybody but, you know, my colleagues that exist in other jurisdictions. So I think that's another great area where research can add value. And the last thing that I think, you know, research can add value, and at least in my life, is being the canary in the coal mine for what's coming up or what are the types of things that you need to think about. I'm sitting on an industry panel next week, and one of the questions that I was posed to think about was, you know, Khalil, you come from an academic background, but is, you know, for somebody who's in industry, just going to conferences like this and, you know, reading random emails or thoughts with colleagues, is that enough to stay apprised of the changes that are going on in the industry? And, you know, I don't think it is, and there's really a gap of having somebody be the voice in the world to say, 2 years ago, daily fantasy, this is something that is coming up and that you need to think about if you're a regulator, you want to get ahead of this. And that voice doesn't exist right now, and I think, you know, a center like this and other people in academic centers, organizations like GRIO are really could be those voices that help guide industry, help guide regulators to know, you know, how does technology changing affect what's coming up, and how do preferences of, you know, the new generations change how you should think about your regulatory models? Because it's a long process when it comes to things like that, and we definitely need the experts to tell us when the seas are starting to change. Thank you very much.
So you've heard a lot about the 50-50 partnership between the law school and IGI and the inspiration that Bo is and the catalyst, and you've seen that this week. And so I very much enjoyed being the other guy, right, the quiet guy in the background. It suits my personality. So I want to talk to you about two things, right, the potential of a university and the LLM degree that we established at the law school. Andre was talking about how he is new to Las Vegas. I'm relatively new to my vice provost position. I've had it for all of 3 months now. I started March 1st. And so I'm beginning to see the university from a different lens and have a greater appreciation for the diversity of expertise, the array of talent. It's awesome. But it's scattered and it's siloed in the ways that companies can be, that regulation can be, and that universities can be. So you have a researcher in math or a researcher in law or a researcher in business that are in their different colleges doing good work. And the challenge and the opportunity for a center like this is to bring those folks together. You got a glimpse of that with Bo's description of the patent process in that class, where you need a mathematician, you need business experts, you need the legal minds, you need a developer and a programmer, and we're able in a university at our best to bring all of those people together and create good things. But it's a continuing challenge, and it's one that I think we've worked hard at UNLV to keep building those kinds of bridges and connections, but it is indeed a continuing challenge. The other thing that universities do well is, you know, it's what products should we offer? So one common one that we offer are degrees, right? We're most familiar with that. And so the law school launched a LLM in regulation, gaming law and regulation. We will be in year two in the fall. So we've just finished our first year, graduated the first class. It's very exciting. I want to tell you just a little bit briefly about its structure, because an LLM might not be very familiar to many of you. Talk about the faculty and students, and then kind of what next, right? What other products might we offer, should we offer, how should we tweak our curriculum, et cetera. So first, the LLM is a peculiar animal, I think, because the class, you have to have a JD or the equivalent degree from another country. So it's a master's, but it's a much more narrow master's. We have 12 students this year. We should have about 12 students next year. Please be on the lookout for a one sheet, which of course I didn't bring up here. Do you have one? I'm going to steal one. This is our marketing material, so take it home, share it widely, make copies. What we've done successfully this year is bring students from other countries, right? We have a student from Greece, a student from the Czech Republic, students from Korea and from the Philippines. So in the second year, and I hope this continues as the reputation of the LLM develops, more and more students will find it of value. It's a full-time and a part-time program. So full-time you go for a year, part-time you go for 2 years, but it's kind of designed, again, for a full-time person to finish it in 1 year. So one thing that, you know, I think about a lot, and I'd love for you to think about, is the value of this kind of product, right? So a degree gives you a credential. A degree gives you experience and knowledge. A degree gives you access to, especially here in Nevada and here in Las Vegas, local expertise. On the other side, a degree program is time intensive, taking a year out of your life to come to Las Vegas and earn an LLM is challenging. The part-time option helps that a bit, right? But I'm always thinking about how can we make this more flexible? How can we make it more attractive? And do we just need more products that are less formal than a degree? The course, what we did with the curriculum is try to think about what an LLM student ought to know, right? If you leave the Boyd School of Law and you say you have an LLM in gaming law and regulation, and what knowledge, what basic knowledge should you have? And then how can you go deeper in areas that you're interested in? So we require introduction to gaming law, fundamentals of casino operations and management, which tries to get at the business side rather than just the legal and regulatory side. US gaming law, comparative gaming law, casino resort law, so getting a chance to look at the integrated resort. We've had a sports betting class that's been very popular. Technology, innovation, and gaming, so trying to drill down to kind of the way technology has changed both gaming operations and regulation. We have a course on gaming equipment manufacturers, right? So not a required course, but looking at the different kind of facets of gaming, not just land-based casinos, not just iGaming, but who are the other players in the system. We've been able to offer such a wide variety of courses because we have, you know, we're fortunate. We're here in Las Vegas. We have a great faculty, right? We have people like Jennifer Roberts, whom you heard about before. We have Greg Gimignani, who's a partner at Dickinson Wright. We have some visiting professors come, so for short stints. So Keith Miller is a professor at Drake Law School. He's taught the sports betting course and is, you know, able to join us for short periods. Mark Lerner, many of you might know, a longtime lawyer at Bally's Technology, teaches the gaming equipment manufacturers course. Right, so just very fortunate in having that kind of expertise here in our backyard. And of course, Tony Cabot has been here to teach our comparative course, comparative gaming law, and the introductory law. Right, so that's a great fortune that we have here that's hard to replicate in other areas, and we've tried to put them to good use. We were able to develop the LLM by building on our JD program. Right? In other words, we've offered many of these courses to our JD students for many years, and so the idea was how can we organize those courses in a way that we can make a single degree out of them. So the LLM students and the JD students take classes together, and that's been, I think, helpful for both populations. We've also been fortunate, the last one, is we've hired Brian Wall, who's over there, as our director of graduate programs, right? So we have people in the building, we're developing infrastructure to both make sure the student experience is a good one, to make sure that the curriculum makes sense and that we can make improvements, and to thicken the relationships we have with the community. So for example, we offer an externship as part of the degree program, and it's very popular with students, as you might imagine, and so you need people to make sure those relationships are useful for the students, right? Are they getting a meaningful externship experience? And for the placement, are they getting good students that are delivering good work? I want to spend a moment about the challenges and successes. So I think I'm going to start with the successes. You've heard a lot about new initiatives at UNLV, from the center to the IGI. They're developing many more centers. We have the LLM. So I think one success that I'm proud of is that we're able to create kind of tangible markers of progress, right? It's one thing to think about what can we do better or what should we do better in the future. It's another thing to actually execute and to have something that we can say, we did that in 2015, we did that in 2017. And so to have an LLM program is really, I think, a great accomplishment. The challenge, though, is it how good is the product, right? Is an LLM useful to our students? Is it, you know, how many students should we have? You know, I think the number is about 10 or 12. In other words, I think it would be unfair to take tuition money from 40 LLM students, educate them, and then send them out to the market expecting that they would get, that there are 40 gaming jobs each year awaiting them, right? So it's kind of thinking about who's the market, who's the audience. Another challenge for the university generally is thinking about audience. In other words, the connections between regulation and law are obvious and close, right? But you can also imagine different audiences, right? We have regulators, lawyers, operators, students. So we're constantly thinking about which audiences the law school should address, which audiences the center should address, which audiences the IGI should address, and when we come together, right? But that's just a continuing question for us. The what next is an open question. It's online, probably. Lots of schools around the nation are offering online degree programs, and I think we'd like to do that in law and in other areas. It's certificate programs, perhaps. And Andre, you saw a nice kind of array of modules that I think are useful for people to take. So some of those might be offered through the centers, others might be offered through the law school, combinations, right? But thinking about what other kinds of products besides degrees would be useful. How we better reach the international community, right? So one way that the international community has access to the expertise at UNLV is they come here as degree students, right? How else can we better access or spread the word, if you will, to international students? So I just wanted to, in my closing remarks, and then open it up to everyone, you know, give you a glimpse of what we're doing here at the law school. We've been very fortunate to have a generous partner like the IGI. Bo's been doing this for many, many years, and he's been both, he's helped educate us about the possibilities of gaming, and then just been very helpful and generous and really partnering with us with future initiatives. So couldn't have asked for a better partner. So with that, I want to thank first all of the panelists for your great presentations and give you guys the first crack at asking questions. So what questions do you have for us? Yes. Beat you to it. We've got one. We've got two. Right. So one, I'll talk about at the law school, we have a journal. And now the name is going to, the Gaming Law. Thank you. Gaming Law Journal. It's easy enough to remember. So that has been a partnership for, gosh, I would say about 10 to 15 years between the law school and the International Masters of Gaming Law. It publishes two issues a year. Go to our website, and you can find the past issues. And if you contact the journal, you can get on the subscription list, and we'll send you more.
Also, the editor-in-chief of that journal, Adam Alice, is here today. So if you want to find him on the Hoover app, I'm sure.
And do you want to say a few words about the...
Sure. You all, in your registration packets, received a copy of the International Gaming Institute's peer-reviewed journal, Gaming Research and Review. That has conventionally been a multidisciplinary romp, certainly inviting folks to submit from any number of different disciplines. And so, yeah, that also obviously is an outlet. And we've talked about ways in which we might combine forces in focusing specifically via special issues or those sorts of things down the road, more specifically on a topic that both have published on in the past, which is gaming regulation.
And I'll speak for the editors of the Gaming Law Journal. They are always, always, always looking for submissions. So please don't be shy.
Pauline, that's a very good question. I think it's got to be a combination of more than one approach. Mm-hmm. It is important to listen to the scholars, and hopefully, as we've just done with this program of ours, to hear what they say and what they think, you know, are the interesting topics. However, I think it would be a big mistake not to listen to the people whom we really want to influence. What are the issues you know, that are important to them. You know, I always say there's two types of regulators. You get the regulator, and remember that you've got government as the shareholder. And what they do by way of legislation, they appoint the regulator to stand between the public and the operator, right? And to mitigate those two interest groups, which is often quite a tricky role. Now, you get the one type of regulator that would get the marching orders from the shareholders, government, and implement it and not ask a single question about it. But then you would get what I would call thoughtful regulators, and we have some of them here today. Chairman Crosby is here from Massachusetts. I regard him as a thoughtful regulator. I see Peter Nasens from Belgium is here, and there are many others around the world who are really thinking about what they're doing, how they regulate, does these regulations make sense, and what they do is they go back to the shareholders and say, whoa, you know, the legislation you've given us and the regulations that have been made, we ought to maybe rethink it, because having been in that position where we mitigate between these two parties, we think there's different ways of doing it, we think the problem is different to what it was 5 years ago, and we need to listen, you know, to what the scholars are saying, what the industry is saying, the suppliers, and so on. And it's really that group that I want to establish the relationship with in the first instance, and to hear them, what are their thoughts, what are the things that they think, you know, we ought to focus on in our research program, and hopefully to get scholars to plug into that and help us to come up with evidence-based research that would facilitate the issues that they face at the moment. Does that make sense?
Yes, and I think that you're in a unique position to push everybody a little bit to kind of like outside the usual box, and kind of create us by putting them together, and also then kind of challenge the thing from the off the usual path.
And actually, just the other point I thought you brought up that I love, because again, it's the very spirit of this conference, is bringing new minds and new perspectives, new methodologies into the field. Mm. And I'm going to embarrass Ashley Colleen in the back of the room. Andre already pointed her out. Ashley, wave to the crowd. Ashley is employed at the Gaming Institute. We brought her on board specifically because she has a master's in public policy from the University of Utah, a very well-respected master's program in public policy analysis, very quantitatively driven. She's brought methodologies and tools to analyzing this. She's not somebody who has a gaming background, but she's somebody who has a methodological tool chest, if you will, that I've been amazed by. And so in particular, looking at the project, just as to illustrate that Andre referenced, which is this delicate dance between innovation and regulation, she came up with a model to look at measuring various steps along the way, turning that into something that's measurable in a way that just blew my mind when she first presented it to me, because I don't have a public policy analysis background. It's not my training. So I love that spirit, and when you asked, are you going to have people on staff who are tasked with doing these things, certainly Ashley epitomizes that. So connect with Ashley if you're all interested.
And I'll just add just one more quick one. That I've seen that also at the law schools. We've not had full-time law professors with gaming backgrounds, or we've not had, and we don't have. But as the center has developed, as the LLM degree has developed, my colleagues who write and research in other areas, health law, labor law, mental health law, have begun to contribute articles, right, and research on gaming. So they don't consider themselves gaming researchers by identity, but they too are bringing the methodologies from their areas of expertise in. So that's a slow process, but I've seen it happen with at least three of my colleagues, and I suspect there will be more. Yes, sir.
I'd just like to follow up on Andre's answer a moment ago to the question back here. A theme that I haven't heard yet this morning at the session is sort of another problem that I would think would be a very significant one for many regulators. And you referred just now to two kinds of regulators, the thoughtful one who pays attention to the interests of the stakeholders and the thoughtless one who just robotically implements what the political masters want. But then presumably there's a third kind of regulator who pays too much attention to the interests of one of the stakeholders. But I haven't heard sort of themes around regulatory capture mentioned this morning. I would think that one advantage we would hope to get from having regulators across jurisdictions pulled together would not only be the sharing of knowledge, but also empowering them, right? I mean, if I'm a regulator and I'm feeling isolated because I'm under threat of capture, and there's a lot of pressure on me coming from the powerful stakeholder, being able to refer to best practice, being able to refer to canons of what best practice is, because those have been established, would be one of the key defense mechanisms that I would want to be able to reach for when I'm trying to defend my integrity and my independence.
Yeah. I think that's very important. And let me just say that, and it links back to the question about, are we going to come up with a regulatory journal? They already are, as Bo and his slides indicated. There are already many platforms around the world where some of these discussions are already starting to take place. We don't want to duplicate that. And we don't want to come up again with something where we create our own little journal on regulation or our own little conference on regulation. Because we're going to very quickly, as is the case already in many cases, become isolated, from the rest. We need to get these stakeholders together. And there is already an international regulatory association. There's already an American Gaming Regulators Association, as there's GREF and SAGRA in Africa and so on. And there is a danger in that regulators talk amongst regulators and is not being influenced, from outside. And as much as, there's a danger that academics can talk amongst themselves or industry. And we need to start breaking open, those barriers and influence those barriers. I mean, it's a well-known fact that if you're going to get a number of regulators on a panel, and it's been tried before, and someone suggested it the other day again, you get a number of, CEOs from large manufacturers and operating companies, and we talk about what is it that regulators can do better. Do you for a minute think that that is going to be an open discussion? It's not, right? But there's other forums that we can create where we pull these people together, Don, and I think we agree on this, where it is going to be much easier to open up and influence without necessarily doing it, on a public platform. Is that sort of answering you?
Debbie LaPlante is the principal investigator of a really premier example of a regulator and an academic working together.
And industry.
Exactly. I thought you might want to tell that story because it's just apropos of what people have talked about the way regulators and the industry and academics might work together. You're in charge of a really great example of that.
So, if you want to hear even more, you can come to our panel tomorrow morning. No, but yes, we at the division, we're working with the Gaming Commission, and we're working with currently the slot parlor there that is open in Massachusetts, Plain Ridge Park Casino, to analyze a variety of policies that have been instituted in Massachusetts, including the self-exclusion system. That's in operation, the GameSense information centers, which are on-site education and responsible gambling resources that are staffed, yep, full-time, that they do things like they manage the voluntary self-exclusion, but they also run demonstrations of, like, here's how a slot machine works, and here are the odds, of you actually winning and doing different games and building relationships with the people who go to the slot parlor. And we're also going to be evaluating a piece of software that is going to be installed, as far as we know, the first in the nation, the Play My Way system, which is a responsible gambling tool that people can sign up for. It's voluntary in Massachusetts, and it's a budget setting tool. It provides people reminders when they're approaching, when they've reached, or when they've exceeded the budgets that they have said that they wanted to place on their gambling spending. And we've been working, not only with the commission and with the industry, but also with the Mass Council on Compulsive Gambling, an interested partner, public health partner to really evaluate them and just see what the effects are. And the commission really has been open to the idea of, you know, these are the regulations as we see them now. Once we understand the impacts that they're having on the people that are, you know, affected by those regulations, we'll revisit and we'll make changes as needed. And I think it's just a really good example of how that kind of iterative process can actually work in the real world.
I have a question, actually, for the BC representative, because I think one of the interesting issues that a center on regulation can look at is the fact that in other jurisdictions, non-US jurisdictions, you actually have some regulators who are owners and operators and have to live a schizophrenic life in an interesting and important way. And that contrasts to the American experience, where you're quite right, and many other countries, where the regulator is the buffer between the industry and the revenues going to government, and its lust for revenues and its unwillingness to question where those revenues are coming from. So it would seem to me that an important thing for an institution, even though based in the US, would be to bring in regulators, owners, operators that don't have quite the same tension. They have other tensions, and I'd be interested in hearing about whether that's something that is on the agenda and how you see the schizophrenia that you have to, the provinces have to. I mean, there's other jurisdictions, but that's an extremely important one.
Right, yeah, so to sort of describe the situation in BC, BCLC is responsible for conducting and managing gambling, but we're also regulated by the Gambling Policy Enforcement Branch, and we hire service providers who actually operate on-site casinos. And so that's the dual nature of the role, is that we regulate these service providers, but we're regulated by the Gambling Policy Enforcement Branch. And because of that, I think a lot of the frictions that you might see between a regulator and an operator don't exist between organizations, but exist within our organization. And so the same conversations that a regulator might have with an operator in another jurisdiction, I actually just have with my colleagues. So I might be having a conversation as the director of social responsibility about creating a responsible gambling program and what that needs to look like in the casino that they're responsible for running. And so, you know, we still have the same conversations, but it's just an internal one as opposed to an external one. But I still, you know, need the same, best practices to rely upon and other people to point to. So a lot of the things that, you know, I think are relevant in other jurisdictions are relevant to us. It's just, you know, conversations you don't see publicly as much.
Can I just add to that? It's interesting you raised that, Glenn. Just after the center had been created and it became public, there was a number of calls from the sort of regulators you've just described that said, you know, we're so glad that the center exists because we've got this enormous tension, you know, between ourselves and the operator. And it's often the case where you have a single operator or an operating company where, you know, government and the regulator and the operator are almost, you know, jointly together. And it creates very interesting and unnecessary tensions. And can you help us, you know, to resolve that? So I think there's going to be quite a lot of that coming to the fore. Eva wanted to... Yeah, I think it's a very important one, and we are fortunate in the sense that the industry is pretty well organized. So, you know, you have an AGEM, you know, who's representative of, you know, the manufacturers. You've got in North America the American Gaming Association, and it's going to be very important to work with them and others around the world, you know, as stakeholders to also listen to them. I've raised the issue of the tension between innovation and regulation. That is typically a project that arose from, if you wish, from industry, saying, and not necessarily just from industry, but industry has some concerns about the impact of regulation on innovation. So I think you raise a very important point.
Time for one last question.
Are you planning to do any integration with tribal regulators?
Very good question. And the answer is yes. I've been spending a lot of time the last month or two to gain a better understanding of tribal gaming, which I think would be a huge mistake to be ignored. I mean, apart from the fact that it is a huge sector in this part of the world, I think there's a lot of ground there for assisting and building capacity and helping. But again, the trick is going to be not to do it in a way where we offend the existing structures that are in place. There is, both at federal level and at tribal level, there are already structures in place. And the importance is going to be to work with those authorities in getting closer to those communities and understanding what are the issues that they face, that face them, and trying to assist them. I've attended NIGA a month or two ago in Phoenix, which was a real eye-opener to me. I've spoken to a number of people who are close to the tribal communities, who understand, you know, the needs there, and I appreciate, you know, that there are problems, that there are needs, and we want to do it in a sensitive way. I mean, one of the things that come up all the time is we know that online gaming is coming. We need to get trained in that particular area. So there's already been a need expressed by a number of tribes, and it's something that we're working on at the moment, and we hope that we can address fairly soon.
I want to thank our panelists. I want to thank you for joining us this morning, and to keep things moving on time, I will now dismiss you all, but please go to the next panel. We'll see everyone at lunch, so thanks again.